Indian policy continued to be harshly criticized by reformers all over the United States. Roosevelt insisted Lummis issue a formal apology to Burton. Natalie and George knew about Lummis's many grievances against federal Indian policy. But in May 1903, when they pulled their horse and wagon up before the government buildings at the foot of Third Mesa, Natalie most likely did not know how she might be mistaken for yet another of Lummis's female subversives. That Natalie and George managed to move into a room in the BIA housing at New Oraibi is a testament to Natalie's compelling personality and George's gentle manner. However, the atmosphere in Hopiland was charged with suspicion and distrust, and their activities were closely scrutinized. If Natalie had access to copies of Out West and Lummis's articles about Burton's Reign of Terror, and if she knew about Gertrude Gates and her eviction from Indian country, the antagonistic environment did not dampen Natalie's enthusiasm to visit the Hopis. However, it likely dampened her acknowledgement of the purpose of her journey through Indian country, to hear and record Indian music. The singing of native songs and chants was strictly forbidden. Had a federal official asked to inspect Natalie and George's gear, they would have known that the diminutive, engaging, and educated musician named Natalie Curtis was most certainly crossing the high desert to break the law, because the wagon was loaded with crates packed with a bulky Edison phonograph. After Natalie and George settled into rooms among the other white outsiders in the government buildings at the foot of Third Mesa, Natalie, with George and a translator, one of the English-speaking Hopi boys who had attended a government school, hiked up the steep, exposed, cliff-hugging trail to Old Oraibi. With her field notebook in hand and dressed in what would become her desert uniform, khaki skirt, white long-sleeved shirt, lace-up leather boots, and a broad-brimmed hat, Natalie introduced herself to the villagers. Oraibi, like each of the Hopi villages of First, Second, and Third Mesas, was a cluster of several-storied mud and stone dwellings built around small plazas perched on the narrow top of an island mesa, hundreds of feet above the shimmering floor of the desert. The first Spanish priests in the southwest built a chapel and mission near Oraibi in the early years of the 17th century, but the Hopis peaceably and tenaciously resisted Catholicism and maintained their own spiritual traditions. After the Spanish were thrown out of Arizona and New Mexico in the uprising of 1680, the Franciscans never returned to Hopiland. The Hopis adopted the Spaniards' sheep, burros, and horses, and when Natalie arrived in 1903, the desert landscape below Third Mesa boasted orchards of peach and apricot trees. The Hopis were a predominantly vegetarian culture, and the daily meal included maize, corn, beans, squash, watermelons, and sunflowers. Corn was the primary food source, but among the Hopi, as among all desert dwellers, water was the supreme life source. A rainstorm was a celebrated event, and every adult and child participated in the capture, collection, and storage of the precious commodity. Hopi was, and is, a matrilineal monogamous society, and Natalie was introduced to women who owned and occupied their own dwellings in the villages. Women also owned cultivated land, including some of the orchards and horses. The village of Oraibi and the people of Hopiland surpassed Natalie's expectations. Every act of life was ceremonial, poetic, symbolic. I was not prepared to find a people with such definite art forms, such crystallized traditions, beliefs, and customs. The music of the Hopi astounded her. I had not been in Oraibi 24 hours before my mental picture of the scope of music faded like a desert mirage, revealing a new and far-off horizon, stretching boundless as the desert itself, a new world of art. Natalie made friends easily, and her residence below Third Mesa was soon visited by her Hopi neighbors from dawn until dusk. My workshop, as I called it, was one of the government houses at the foot of the mesa. In one of these houses I had my phonograph, and here the Indians collected daily with true Hopi curiosity to peek in at the windows, to stare at the pahana, white or American woman, and to join in the fun and excitement of singing into the machine. Indeed, I had but to be seen issuing from the house where I lived to be followed by a stream of Hopis, women with babies on their backs, men on their way to the fields, children just off to school. The Indians opened my door and entered my little house as unceremoniously as they did each other's. I always welcomed them and offered them the customary empty boxes to sit on. There were never enough to go around, and half my visitors sat on the floor. But this was Hopi style. Boxes are an innovation of civilization. In the month and a half that Natalie was among the Hopis, she cultivated relationships with everyone who would talk with her. With native guides, she traveled by wagon into the vast and often labyrinthine landscape of deep unnamed canyons, sheer cliffs, wide washes, and treacherous rock chasms to reach the desert camps and outposts where Hopi singers and storytellers were found. Natalie spent entire days on foot or in the saddle, and slept in a bedroll on the ground under the stars or in a cabin or tent near a trading post if one was nearby. 6 months after leaving New York, Bogey and Mimsy would not have recognized their daughter, the confident desert traveler. Natalie's physical and emotional strength increased with every week spent under the sky of Indian country. Her body was healed by the landscape, and her heart had reconnected with her passion in the music of the people who called the desert home. During one desert trek, a sandstorm engulfed Natalie and her Hopi guide and literally blew away the road. They walked into the night, and as the sky cleared and became luminous with stars, Natalie's guide began to sing. The wild beauty of the music and the soulful, uninhibited quality of the guide's voice astonished Natalie. Even as her classically educated ear struggled to understand the pitch and cadence of his song, Natalie attempted to sing along. I joined my voice to that of my guide, not a soul to hear, not one to comment or criticize, only the desert stretching broad and far, only the craggy buttes and cliffs, only the heavens and those great bright stars. What freedom to sing one's very soul out into such a wide, vast night! We lifted our faces to the sky and sang. Every act of Hopi life was accompanied by song, planting fields, grinding corn, dancing, putting children to sleep, watching the approach of the yellow light, dawn, the setting of the sun, rain. Every season, every daily chore was honored by song. Among the Hopis, Natalie was surrounded by music. For Natalie, whose entire life had been the pursuit of music, life was music. In the remote desert world of the Hopis, Natalie was among people who understood what she had always known. Music was life. Before attempting to talk with any of the Hopis in Oraibi, Natalie went to meet the village leaders. The most important meeting was her introduction to the elderly Kikmungwai, village chief Lolalomai, his daughter Noyasoya, and his sister Pony Anamosi. Lolalomai, very good, was about 80 years old in 1903 and was one of only a few Hopi who had traveled out of Hopi land. In the mid-1880s, Lolalomai had gone with the trader Thomas Keams to Washington to ask President Chester Arthur to stop Navajo encroachment onto Hopi lands. Impressed by Euro-American civilization, Lolalomai asked the federal government to open a school at Keams' trading post. By 1903, however, Lolalomai's support of federal Indian schools, especially those under Superintendent Burton, had ended. Natalie sought the elderly chief's approval of her intention to write down and also record on the Edison phonograph the songs of his people. She was taken by her interpreter, a Hopi lad who, although blind, led with sure foot the way up the steep rocky trail to the village to meet Lolalomai, whom they found seated on his housetop spinning, for in Hopi land it is the men who spin and weave. After Natalie explained that she had come to talk about something that concerned your people, Lolalomai invited her to climb the ladder and join him on the rooftop. From the flat-topped roof, with its 360-degree view of Third Mesa and Hopi land, Natalie told Lolalomai, through her interpreter, that if Hopi songs were not written down, they would be forgotten. Lolalomai understood the value of recording his people's songs, but he was fearful of repercussions against his village if Superintendent Burton learned about their collaboration. Natalie assured the chief that she would not reveal the names of collaborators, nor speak of their sessions to the whites associated with the federal government. The chief gave Natalie's work his blessing, and in late spring of 1903, Natalie began to collect and record the songs of the Hopi. Although Natalie and George were offered food and shelter in the government-issue headquarters at Third Mesa, and Natalie made friends at Oribe and the other Hopi villages, her presence, like that of all whites, was the source of heated discussion among the Indian people. It was a volatile time in Tusayan, and at Oribe, Natalie was involved with individuals who were at the center of the political firestorm that would soon be known as the Oribe Split. Beginning in the late 1800s, there was disagreement among the Hopis of Oribe as to the tribe's cooperation and interaction with white America. By 1900, the disagreement had become a rift that divided the village into two factions, the Friendlies and the Hostiles. The Friendlies, who included Chief Lololomai and his family, although ambivalent about interaction with the white world that sought to diminish their traditional way of life, believed that at least a little cooperation with the whites was necessary for peaceful survival. The Hostiles wanted nothing to do with the Two Hearts, the white-skinned people Hopi prophecy had predicted would come with guns and poison. Smallpox had arrived in 1899 and was epidemic by 1901. And when Burton and the BIA began to forcibly remove Hopi children to boarding schools, even Chief Lololomai began to question his friendly attitude toward the whites. If Natalie knew how fractured and volatile the native community on and below Third Mesa was in 1903, she did not let it stop her recruitment of prospective collaborators. And in spite of her membership in the white race, the people of Hopiland opened their homes and shared their music and stories. 3. Capturing the Wind. Single women making their way to individual destinies. Who in the home circle understands them? If they try to share what they have found in their further reach, who wants it? Elizabeth Shepley Sargent. By the 1st of June, news reached Natalie in Oribe that a close friend of the family had died in New York. George was working at a cattle ranch when he received the same news, and he traveled to Third Mesa, packed up Natalie and her gear, and went with her to Winslow, where they caught the Santa Fe Railway's eastbound train. Natalie had been summoned home by Mimsy and Bogey to sing at the memorial service of the family's deceased friend. Natalie returned, the dutiful daughter, but it was immediately obvious to the family that 9 months in the West had changed her. She was not the professionally ambivalent, emotionally fragile woman who had left Washington Place last fall on the arm of her older brother. Months spent in primitive quarters in frontier towns, in austere rooms at government agencies, and in cowboy camps and outposts, had transformed and matured Natalie. At the memorial service, a suntanned, buoyant Natalie surprised her family and friends by sharing several of the songs she had learned from the Hopis. She spoke briefly about the people and cultures so rapidly vanishing in the American West, and how she believed it was important to record and preserve Indian music. That the Indians of America had music was a revolutionary concept to most New Yorkers, even among the Curtis's progressive circle of friends. Cultured people in the East, except the few who were actively interested in the work of Indian welfare, knew little or nothing of the Indian, Natalie's younger brother Bridgem wrote. To them he probably appeared as the romantic, painted savage of Cooper's tradition, or as the taciturn and treacherous enemy of the border warfare days, or as the debauched and grotesque outcast of the frontier town. And to them, I think, Natalie's relation of what she had seen and heard was a revelation. Natalie didn't so much settle into life on Washington Place as she unsettled the life of the Curtis family with her tenacious pursuit of a new mission. On arrival in the city, Natalie drafted her first article about the Southwest and handed it to one of Uncle George's colleagues, who published the piece in Harper's Weekly. Boldly titled, An American Indian Composer, it was to be the first of scores of magazine articles Natalie would write about the people, music, and landscape of the American Southwest in the next 2 decades. Bogey and Mimsy knew from experience with Natalie's previous self-appointed tasks that her new calling would likely not be a casual hobby, but a rigorous immersion. For Natalie to undertake her new mission, she had to overcome 2 substantial obstacles. She needed funding to cover the cost of expeditions into Indian country, and she needed to find a way around the federal law that essentially undermined her ability to find and work with Native collaborators during her expeditions. Within a few weeks of returning to New York, Natalie contacted the one person who could quickly and absolutely grant her safe passage through Indian country, President Theodore Roosevelt. By mid-July, she had secured a personal audience with the president at the Roosevelt's summer home, Sagamore Hill, on Oyster Bay, across Long Island from Natalie's family home in Far Rockaway. She was able to gain access to the president so easily and quickly because of Roosevelt's long association with Uncle George Curtis. George William Curtis was considered a founding member of the Republican Party, and he was also among those who, in league with Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge, famously revolted against the old line Republican Party at the Stormy Party Convention in 1884 and created the Independent Republicans, also known as the Mugwumps. George Curtis did not live to see his friend become governor of New York or president of the United States. But in his niece, Roosevelt surely saw much of his friend's charisma, creative passion, and intelligence. Roosevelt likely recognized a bit of himself as well in the diminutive person of Natalie Curtis, a woman who shared his own tremendous capacity for work and a driving need to be productive. In Roosevelt's Sagamore Hill study, Natalie candidly outlined what she believed were the numerous injustices perpetrated by the federal government on the land and culture of the Indians of the American West. Natalie pitched her cause with unflinching conviction. The president knew that every word she uttered, every opinion she offered, was the truth as she understood it. Her Uncle George had done precisely the same in lectures and speeches and in his political columns in Harper's. Natalie would look back at her meeting with the President of the United States when she was but little more than a girl and recall Roosevelt's capacity to consider a radically opposite viewpoint. Roosevelt patiently listened to Natalie's comprehensive litany about the benighted policies of the Indian Bureau in Washington and its ruthless campaign of destruction of all things pertaining to the indigenous culture of the red race. Of course, he was well-versed in these complaints. Even as Natalie sat in his study at Sagamore Hill, Roosevelt's college pal, Charles Lummis, was publishing inflammatory articles about Superintendent Burton and about Roosevelt's Bureau of Indian Affairs in Out West magazine. It was a prickly subject, but something about Natalie Curtis's plea and her straight-from-the-shoulder truthfulness and the exotic, strangely beautiful song she carried from the faraway desert village of Oraibi captured Roosevelt's imagination and his admiration. Natalie had impeccable credentials. She was a classically trained musician, the daughter of a respected New York doctor, and the niece of a friend and political ally. But perhaps of more importance to the president in 1903, Natalie Curtis was an astute eyewitness of current events in Indian country. She had traveled into Native America and undertaken what she believed was important work in a difficult, even hostile, environment. She had also managed to make friends with the elusive Hopis, and she meant to return. Roosevelt respected anyone, regardless of color or class, who could produce under pressure. When the 28-year-old Natalie Curtis came to his summer home to talk about Indian policy, Roosevelt recognized a person of perspicacity, committed to a serious mission. Natalie told the president she planned to continue with her recording of Indian music. In defense of her law-breaking task, she insisted that any attempt to educate the native people by the white people ought to be framed and informed by a thorough study of Indian culture. "They can teach us as well as we them," she lectured the president. Roosevelt's recognition of the value of native culture was, in Natalie's words, instantaneous. "I am thoroughly in sympathy with the idea of preserving and, if possible, of developing the art, the music, the poetry of the Indian," Roosevelt said, with that emphasis of conviction that made his decision like powerful strokes of a forging hammer beating out results. "It fits in with my policies of conservation, and I consider this question, the conservation of Indian art in our education of Indians, important enough to include in my next message to Congress." Before Natalie departed Sagamore Hill, Roosevelt assured her that although he did not know anything about Indian song poems or Native poetry, her effort to keep this song literature alive, had his immediate and hearty support. Remarkably, within hours of Natalie's departure from the Roosevelt home, the president penned and sent off several official letters, including one addressed to federal Indian agents for Natalie to carry into Indian country. "I desire that every opportunity be given Miss Natalie Curtis to travel through all Indian reservations and to fully investigate and report on, to me or any official under me, all matters pertaining to the well-being, the education, the artistic development and industries of the Indians." That same day, July 22, 1903, Roosevelt sent a letter to Ethan Allen Hitchcock, instructing his Secretary of the Interior to consider Natalie's proposals regarding the preservation of Indian art and music. "Her desire is to see the exceptionally interesting artistic side of the life of these Indians preserved. She feels, and I think she is entirely right, that the one side in which American life is weak is the artistic, and that we ought not to throw away anything which will give us a chance to develop artistically." Hitchcock and his staff, one of whom described Natalie Curtis as an intense little person, were most unhappy about the president's instructions. Hitchcock was already disgruntled with Roosevelt's willingness to take advice and counsel from ordinary folks. Now the president was considering bringing to Congress proposals made by a person and a woman Hitchcock considered to be nothing more than a do-gooder. Copies of Roosevelt's letters dispatched on her behalf reached Natalie at Wavecrest several days later. She wrote Roosevelt a thank-you note on July 29th. "Though you say that your power is not unlimited, the incisive force, clarity of purpose, and promptness of action with which you have met each issue in your career make us feel that any movement receives an enormous impetus by your championship." Natalie took the opportunity to once more urge Roosevelt to make the finding of solutions to the Indian question a primary focus of his administration. She added that she would be investigating the Indian schools in the East as well as those in the American West. "I am full of plans," she wrote to Roosevelt, "but shall not take your time further." But Natalie would take a good deal more of Roosevelt's time that summer, and in many summers to come. In spite of high-level naysayers and politically powerful disapprovers, Natalie's self-proclaimed mission had overcome a major obstacle, the federal government. Her passion was morphing into a formal vocation, but her vision still needed to secure sponsorship. Bogie and Mimsy Curtis were moderately wealthy, but they could not or would not finance the comprehensive project now evolving in Natalie's mind. The recording of not just the music of the Hopis and the Navajos, but of every Indian tribe in the United States. Natalie spent the summer and fall in New York, transcribing the song she had secretly recorded in Hopiland. She also took her presidentially sanctioned plan for a research trip to gather more Indian music and ceremonial material to wealthy family friends and colleagues, from whom she hoped to garner financial support. Natalie explained to potential patrons that her mission was to preserve Indian music as close to the original form, sound, and translation as possible. Natalie's classical training and her finely tuned ear, combined with her socially gregarious and charismatic nature, made her well qualified for the task. Although Natalie accepted the prevalent attitude of white America that the Native American world was in its twilight years, their traditions and culture all destined for extinction in the tidal wave that was the modern, industrial world, Natalie believed in the Indian world's inherent value. She also believed that white Americans, beginning with herself, had much to learn from Indian America. Later that summer, on one of those stifling days in late August when all New York panted and closed blinds, Natalie left Wavecrest and the cooling breezes found along the Long Island shoreline and went into the city to visit Charlotte Osgood Mason. Natalie and her mother had met Mason, the friendly but overbearing wife of a wealthy New York physician, in the 1890s at the meetings and lectures given by the Theosophists. Mason was a generous philanthropist and likely at the top of Natalie's list of possible benefactors for her Indian music project. When Mason asked Natalie to come to her Park Avenue apartment on a mysterious errand, Natalie obliged. It was only after Natalie reached her apartment that the reason for Mason's summons was revealed. We looked from the window at a crowd that had assembled without. Standing before the front door, in the midst of the crowd, we saw an old friend, Frank Mead, fresh from the West, with the breath of the Arizona desert still upon him. Behind him in the crowd was a darker face looking out above an enormous black-and-white Apache basket urn. Frank Mead, a Philadelphia architect Natalie had met with George in Arizona, and his basket-toting friend, Yavapai, known as Mojave Apache at that time, Chief Pelia, were to be Mason's guests. Pelia was wide-eyed and awed, and moved about the luxurious apartment as if in a dream. Once everyone settled down, Pelia was reluctant to release the basket, and held it in both hands for most of Natalie's visit. Mead informed Natalie of what Mason already knew, that he and Pelia had come east so that the Yavapai chief might ask President Roosevelt to grant the Yavapais their own reservation at an old Arizona military post, Camp McDowell. White settlers had encroached on the Yavapais' lands in the Verde Valley, and numerous requests over several years to officials in Washington for resolution of this problem had fallen on deaf ears. The Yavapai were homeless, hungry, and desperate. It was obvious why Mason had beckoned Natalie into the city on such a humid, hot August day. Mason had surely heard all about Natalie's informal and very successful meeting with Roosevelt at Sagamore Hill, and she wanted Natalie's help in obtaining a meeting for Mead and Chief Pelia. Had the request been for someone other than Frank Mead, and for a cause other than Indian rights, she might have been annoyed with Mason. Mead, a New Jersey native, had traveled and lived in North Africa and the Middle East, where he was influenced by architecture that reflected cultural style and indigenous design, and also blended with the landscape. In 1902, he returned to the United States, gave up his position at an architecture firm in Philadelphia, and headed into the American Southwest. The dress, traditions, and architecture of Native America resonated with the iconoclastic Mead, and when Natalie met him in Arizona, he had become involved with the Indian rights movement. Several months before the August meeting in Mason's apartment, Natalie had penned a letter that introduced her new friend Frank Mead to her new friend Charles Lummis. Mead wanted to meet Lummis and others in Southern California, who shared his architectural passion for the aesthetic that would soon emerge into the arts and crafts movement. Mead also wanted to connect with Lummis's circle of Indian rights advocates. Natalie told Lummis that the 38-year-old Mead shared his artistic and idealistic concerns, and that he was a rare person who exemplified Polonius's dictum, "To thine own self be true." Natalie agreed to help Mead and Chief Pelia meet the president, and the evening after she returned to Long Island, she sent a note to Roosevelt about Pelia. The next morning, Natalie had a response. The president would see Mead and the chief within the week. Natalie accompanied Mead and a well-soaped and combed Pelia and his oversized Yavapai basket to the president's home on Oyster Bay. Pelia presented Roosevelt with the basket, a gift from his people, and then pleaded for a reservation for his homeless tribe. Mead followed Pelia's plea with a practical plan for obtaining the land the Yavapai wanted to live upon and the establishment of a reservation at Fort McDowell, northeast of Phoenix. After listening to Mead and Pelia's impassioned pitch for a reservation for the Yavapai, Roosevelt agreed without 5 minutes' hesitation to throw his support behind their proposal. The president must have been able to look past Mead's social eccentricities, because he soon appointed Mead special agent in charge of securing the Yavapai's lands and settling disputes with the white squatters. After Mead and Pelia's late August visit, Natalie wrote the president a lengthy letter outlining why Mead ought to be considered for the job as Roosevelt's supervisor of all Pueblo Indians and allowed to set up a model agency in Arizona where Indian arts would be fostered. Roosevelt did not adopt nor implement all of Natalie's ideas, but he did appoint Mead his special supervisor to oversee the BIA agents and superintendents in 4 states and 2 territories in the Southwest. Reflecting on Roosevelt's ability to act decisively and quickly on matters he believed warranted immediate relief, Natalie wondered if the red tape that so frequently tied the hands of decision-makers in Washington was actually a regional affliction. It is a fact that life in the West does produce real men. Theodore Roosevelt owed his power of action and his driving force to the stimulus of those early days on a cattle ranch. If Washington had been perched within the neighborhood of Pike's Peak, instead of having been sunk in a sluggish, swampish flat, who knows but that red tape might unwind as steadily and swiftly as a stock ticker. Shortly after Meade and Pelley's meeting with the president, Charlotte Mason offered her patronage to Natalie's Indian Music Project. Natalie did not leave for the Southwest immediately, but remained on the East Coast, lecturing about Indian music and the urgent need to record and preserve it. Her plea attracted another important sponsor and advocate, the New York-based businessman and philanthropist George Foster Peabody. George Foster Peabody was a progressive thinker, social reformer, and a self-made millionaire. He is remembered by the prestigious Peabody Awards in Broadcasting, which are named for him. Peabody was a partner in the Brooklyn-based Spencer Trask & Company that during the 1880s and 90s went into business in several very lucrative fields, including electrical infrastructure and the financing and construction of railroads. Peabody was an active member of the Episcopal Church, which advocated the education of minorities, especially in the South. Beginning in the 1880s, Peabody served as a trustee and board member of several schools and colleges, including the Hampton Institute in Hampton, Virginia, a school that offered African and Native American students training in a wide variety of trades and creative skills. Peabody may have learned of Natalie's Indian Project in conversations with his colleague, Charlotte Mason, who also sat on the Hampton Institute's Board of Trustees, or Natalie may have taken the initiative herself and told Peabody she was raising money to collect and preserve Indian music. Peabody liked the project and by the autumn of 1903 gave Natalie $1,000 for her next expedition into Indian country. With money in her pocket, Roosevelt's letter of safe passage in her hand, and Brother George again by her side, Natalie returned to Hopi Land in the fall. No longer afraid of Burton and his BIA police, Natalie spoke openly about her mission, and the federal agents who had made her work nearly impossible 6 months before now strewed my path with courtesies and called on me before breakfast with offers of help. Natalie headed out on horseback with only a pencil and notebook, a helpful brother, and at times some young Indian who had been to school and learned English, to find the eldest Hopi chiefs and singers. The bulky Edison and its wax cylinders were left in her room below Third Mesa. Handwritten notations were the only practical recording method in the desert outback. To accurately record an Indian song or chant on paper was a task of almost unimaginable difficulty, even for a professional musician. George was awed by his sister's gift. Natalie's ear for music was so marvelous that she could set down, without the help of a phonograph, the strange melodies and rhythms that are so different from the white man's music, though to be sure the Indian singer might have to repeat several times before Natalie knew that she had the song correctly. Chief Lololomai was still living with his sister, Pony Onamosi, and a nephew in their home in Oribe. Natalie asked the chief if he would let her record his songs so that they would not be lost to future generations. "Your song is heard, then dies like the wind that sweeps the cornfields and is gone. None knows whither," Natalie told Lololomai. "But if his songs were written down, his people, even to the children of their children, could know your song as if yourself were singing." Lololomai was in his 80s, and he agreed with Natalie's assessment that his songs were destined to be lost like a wind-blown trail. But he worried that there would be repercussions if they proceeded with the recording. Natalie shared her letter from the great chief in Washington, and the elder Hopi agreed to work with her. With a translator beside her, her pencil and notebook, and a wide hat to shade her face from the bright October sun, Natalie sat with the chief on his Oribe rooftop and recorded a thank-you song sung after the village corn harvest. It was a ponderously slow chore, recording on paper Hopi words, tone, notes, and rhythm. "In rhythmic monotone, the old man crooned beside me," Natalie later wrote of that sky-touching session on top of Third Mesa. "Long and diligently I worked at the recording, with the glare of the hot sun on my paper. It was no light task to fix the chant in musical notation." Even Lololomai commented on Natalie's laborious task to make those black marks on the paper. Natalie told the chief, "Your song is a wild blackbird to me, and it may be that the sun will move far along the sky before I have captured it." After several hours on the rooftop, Natalie was satisfied with her transcriptions. Lololomai knelt in prayer as dusk enveloped the ancient pueblo. The shadows on the village street grew long. The sun was sinking. Here and there, a lone Hopi was returning from below with laden burro. Soon the trail would be dotted with homecoming Indians. We sat long in silence, Lololomai, the blind boy, and I. I watched the glow unfold the desert with the mystery of dying day. Silent still, the blind boy and I took our downward way upon the rocky trail. To my companion in his night, the deepening shadow bore no import, but a twilight sadness lay upon my spirit. I thought of the garnered Hopi corn. Will there be many more plantings of poetry and harvesting of song? Darkness closed in, but off beyond, in silver glory, rose the moon. Throughout the fall of 1903, Natalie recorded dozens of native singers. Her task was challenging because of the remoteness and inaccessibility of the Hopi villages, the complexity of their language, and the tonal variations in their music. She likened capturing Hopi music on paper to capturing the wind as it swept down the sides of a rock mesa. To seize on paper the spirit of Hopi music is a task as impossible as to put on canvas the shimmer and glare of the desert. Hopi music is born of its environment. There, in that wide land, under the blaze of the Arizona sun, amid the shifting color of the tinted sands and the purple-blue of the sharp-shadowed rocks, must the songs be heard, to be heard truly. With George, Natalie traversed Indian country on horseback, in a wagon, and, where necessary, on foot. To reach a singer in a sheep camp or in another village meant traveling across the enormous, empty, high desert of the Colorado Plateau, navigating unmarked routes that crossed ledges and canyons, stream beds and rock shelves, and circled buttes and mountains. Their path was always directed by water and the location of a spring or water cache known by the native guides. In 1903 and 1904, and during her subsequent journey through the Southwest in 1905, nearly 60 Hopi songs were recorded in Natalie's notebook and on the phonograph. Letters home enabled the Curtis family back east to follow Natalie and George's progress across Indian country. It was a long and exhausting work, physically and mentally, Bridgem wrote of his sister's recording expeditions. As a rule, her party lived in the guest rooms at the Indian government schools, but frequently the quarters were primitive. There were long rides and drives over rough country, irregular meals, often none at all. Her health, frail at best, was seriously taxed by the hardships. At times it seemed almost impossible to finish the task, but her courage and resolution never faltered. The task was daunting and the conditions difficult. Even so, Natalie was always reluctant to leave the spiritual beauty and the song poets of the Hopi, especially Third Mesa and her friends at Oribe. It was sunset when, for the last time, I climbed the steep trail to the village of Oribe. She wrote the evening before her departure for Williams, Arizona, and the train for home. The level desert seemed a lilac sea, and the outlines of the craggy tablelands were sharp against the flaming sky. Many weeks had passed since I had left the railroad to take the long 2 days drive across the painted desert to the Hopi villages. Tomorrow, I must leave the desert and its freedom for my distant eastern home. Natalie's sense of home was shifting with each visit to the Southwest. On one of her early visits, the Hopi gave her a name that pleased her immensely, Tawimana, woman who sings like a mockingbird, or song maid. Natalie signed her Hopi name alongside her American name on Christmas cards and personal correspondence the rest of her life. Natalie and George departed Hopi land by way of the village of Hano on First Mesa, where they met the celebrated potter, Nampeo, and her family. From First Mesa, they headed their wagon south through the vast country of the Hopi's historic enemy, the nomadic Navajos. Natalie found the Navajos to be industrious, independent, and fearless, with the strength of the warrior and the simplicity of the shepherd. The Navajo is the true son of the silence, the awe, the grandeur of the desert. Natalie made friends among the Navajos, and over the next 2 years would record more than 10 of their ceremonial chants and songs. After her return to New York, the president summoned Natalie to come at once to a luncheon at the White House. It was a simple affair by Washington standards, but the just-off-the-desert Natalie, still adjusting to the noise and pace of modern life, was intimidated by the event and the guests seated around Roosevelt's table. I remember the entire simplicity of that luncheon. Lamb chops and, for dessert, baked apples. Although the party was 12 or 14 in number, the directness with which Roosevelt introduced the subject of the luncheon, the American Indian, was most embarrassing to me, who felt myself nothing but a little snip in the presence of gray-haired senators and cabinet members. For as we found our places at the table, he turned his glasses full upon me and exclaimed with terrifying emphasis, "Miss Curtis will now sing for us an Indian grace." Natalie obliged her host and sang an Indian prayer for the senators and cabinet members, all men, seated at the long table. As the luncheon progressed, it became apparent to Natalie that Roosevelt had assembled this group specifically to talk about Indians. He told the guests in detail about Natalie's translations of Indian song poems and her recordings of Indian music that she had brought to his attention the year before at Sagamore Hill. After lunch, Roosevelt asked Natalie to perform songs learned during her recent visit to Indian country. The president led everyone into the big ballroom, where stood the grand piano, which was quite superfluous for a rendition of Indian songs. Although unprepared, Natalie again obliged the president and performed several musical poems of the desert. She also gave an impromptu talk about her harvestings of Indian songs to the captive audience from Capitol Hill. Natalie was beholden to Roosevelt, but her response to the president was more than gratitude. Natalie considered Roosevelt one of the great heroes of her time. She may, too, have seen a bit of herself in the president, if she allowed such a comparison. "Roosevelt never lost one moment's time in the accomplishment of a purpose," she wrote. "He never preambled or beat about the bush. He snapped at a subject with sharp surety, and the near-sighted eyes behind the thick glasses seemed always intently focused." Roosevelt told Natalie, "I can never afford to be in arrears with anything that I have to do. I must always be abreast or ahead of my tasks." Natalie could not have said it better. 4. The Indian's Book. There is another sort of beauty playing always about the Pueblo country, beauty of cloud and rain and split sunlight, everywhere peace, impenetrable timelessness of peace, as though the Pueblo and all it contains was shut in a glassy fourth dimension, near and at the same time inaccessibly remote. Mary Austin. Natalie spent the summer on the East Coast, working on her recordings and transcriptions at the relentless pace her family was accustomed to, if not always comfortable with. She went to Maine and recorded love, war, medicine, and dance songs, as well as the hunting and creation stories of the surviving tribes of the once great Wabanaki Nation of the Penobscots, Passamaquoddies, Mi'kmaqs, and Maliseets. She also secured more funds, including a $1,000 gift from George Foster Peabody that would enable her to expand the scope of her project to include the music of virtually every Indian tribe in the continental United States. In late fall, Natalie and George donned their travel clothes, packed their khakis, boots, and broad-brimmed hats into their expedition bags, and boarded a train for the Dakotas. It was November, and the lovely, cool days of fall had turned into the cold, wet days of the coming winter. It was not an ideal time of year to be traveling in the rural Midwest, but Natalie's mission had evolved into the writing of a major book about Indian music, and her task would not be deterred by bad weather. Before they headed for the Dakotas, Natalie and George made a short stopover in St. Louis to see the Louisiana Purchase Exposition, celebrating Jefferson's 1804 land deal with the French and the opening of the Trans-Mississippi West. Fairgoers saw the first electric ovens and range tops, and could stand alongside the first automobiles. The Lincoln Museum, built around the log cabin where Abraham Lincoln was born, and Festival Hall, with its gold-leaf dome larger than the one on top of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, were the exposition's showstoppers. While George took voluminous notes, Natalie interviewed and collected songs, stories, and folklore from individuals from the Navajo, Crow, Pawnee, and Chiricahua Apache tribes who were participants in the fair's Indian exhibits. In particular, Natalie wanted to meet Chief Geronimo of the Apaches, who was featured in William Cody's, also known as Buffalo Bill's, Wild West Show on the Pike, the fair's entertainment boulevard. Natalie and George found the most famous of Apache war leaders, making and selling bows and arrows in the Indian Department. Except for newspaper articles, very little had been written about Geronimo. The white world knew about the chief and the Chiricahua Apache people only through the dramatic and often inaccurate stories and legend-worthy accounts given by U.S. military personnel or BIA officials. Geronimo did, however, have a relationship with Roosevelt. The Apache chief would be among the luminaries to ride in the president's 1905 inaugural parade, and Roosevelt may have suggested Natalie seek out the elderly chief at the fair. Natalie and Geronimo had no common language, but with a translator they conversed at length in the Southwest building. Between 70 and 80 years of age, the chief, whose eyes flickered with the tiger flash of a warrior, agreed to let Natalie record on paper several of his songs. The difficulties of recording Geronimo in the exposition hall were nearly as great as recording Chief Lalolomai on the rooftop in Hopiland, but Natalie persevered and, with an interpreter, recorded the words and music of at least two of Geronimo's songs, one of which was so old that none knows who made it. With notebooks bulging with new material and a lengthening list of collaborators, Natalie and George left St. Louis on November 6th on the 1 p.m. train for Chicago. 2 days later, they disembarked from the warmth and comfort of the Pullman car in Sioux City, Iowa, where they did not remain even one night. They transferred their gear directly into a wagon and headed through a cold, drizzling rain to austere quarters at the Winnebago Indian Agency in Nebraska. In the next few days, the rain turned to snow on the Winnebago Reservation. After several days of recording sessions with local musicians, Natalie and George left the Winnebago School and headed their horse and wagon across the frozen winter landscape to the Sioux Agency headquarters at Pine Ridge and Rosebud, South Dakota. Natalie set up her workshop in a hotel, and with the safe passage granted by Roosevelt's letter, went with George in search of Sioux musicians and storytellers in town and out on the reservation. For nearly 8 continuous weeks, Natalie's workshop was set up and taken down in numerous hotel rooms and government headquarters, hauled about on foot and on horseback, and packed into wagons and moved by train cars across Nebraska, the Dakotas, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. Natalie and George witnessed ceremonies and dances rarely seen by non-Indians, the hand games and the mezcal rites of the Arapahos and Cheyennes, the antelope ceremony and wind songs of the Kiowas, and the clandestine spirit dance of the ghost dance religion, considered to have been the trouble that caused U.S. troops to massacre more than 300 Sioux, men, women, and children, at Wounded Knee, still performed by the Dakotas and Pawnees. The Curtises boarded a train for Oklahoma City. After meeting an Indian policeman, Hiomobi, a half-Sioux, half-Cheyenne, who was a high chief of both the Dakotas and Cheyennes, they altered their itinerary and spent the next month among his people in Oklahoma. During the winter on the Great Plains, Natalie recorded over 45 collaborators from 6 tribes, each of them named, and their contributions meticulously catalogued in her notebooks. Just before Christmas, Natalie and George departed the frigid country of the Plains Indians and headed into the country of the Puebloans, the bright high-altitude desert landscape of New Mexico and Arizona. They spent the holidays with Charlotte Mason near Phoenix, where Frank Meade was living among the Yavapai on their new reservation at Fort McDowell. It was Christmas Day when Mrs. Mason and I drove in a canvas-top cart through the Arizona desert to Camp McDowell, Natalie wrote. Pelia, the basket-carrying chief Natalie had met in New York City 14 months before, and his wife had driven into the railway at Phoenix to meet us. Mr. Meade was personally conducting us to the house of the missionary agent on the reservation, and our visit to the Indians had the warmth of a homecoming. On Christmas Day, Pelia and his tribe gathered for a night dance. Natalie, George, Mason, and Meade were the honored guests. A huge bonfire burned on the open desert. Its flames seemed to lick the deep blue purple of the sky. Natalie wrote of that Christmas night. Brilliant moonlight, such moonlight as Easterners have never seen, touched cactus and mesquite and lit the horizon line of hills. The new year of 1905 found Natalie and George at the Indian School in Phoenix, where Natalie recorded students from southwestern tribes. From Phoenix, they traveled east by wagon to New Mexico, where for the next 2 months, Natalie and George lived among the people of Zuni, Acoma, and Laguna Pueblos. By March, Natalie was out of money, and the glorious, exhausting four-month expedition through the Indian country of the Midwest and Southwest came to an end. Natalie returned to New York City, but she did not move back into the Washington Place home of her parents. The Curtis family also maintained a residence at 33 West 69th Street, and it was into this apartment, where her brother George and possibly Bridgem resided, that Natalie unpacked her voluminous notebooks and her weather-worn garments from her four-month expedition. Her research and collection of Indian music were more or less completed, and Natalie's task shifted to her next goal, the assembling and editing of a book about Native American song, dance, ceremonies, and stories. Within a month of her return to the East Coast, Natalie was writing and speaking about her experiences. In a small pamphlet published by G. Shermer, she reproduced three of the corn-grinding songs recorded just a few months earlier at Laguna Pueblo. As she prepared the material for her book, Natalie penned articles for popular audiences about what she had seen and learned. Although she hoped her research about Indian music would earn the respect of her peers, her primary audience was not academia. Natalie wanted to preserve Indian music, but she also wanted to educate average Americans about the federal assimilationist policies that she believed would bring extinction to Native American culture. She wrote articles for the broadly based, predominantly Anglo-American audience that regularly read Harper's, Outlook, Craftsman, and Southern Workman magazines, and newspapers like the New York Times and New York Evening Post. By conventional turn-of-the-century standards, Natalie Curtis was a confirmed spinster when she turned 30 in April 1905. How she thought about herself as a single woman on her 30th birthday can only be guessed at. She had lived most of the last 2 years far from home in the hinterlands of the American West, where an unmarried woman was able to move about and work relatively free of public scrutiny or societal disapproval. If Natalie had a romantic interest or liaison during her late 20s, in New York or out west, neither she nor her family mentioned it in their letters and diaries. The West was a frontier for both the body and soul of those Anglo-Americans, men and women, who ventured into its vast, uncivilized landscape. In contrast, the upper-class world of New York City was still a stronghold of proper Victorian society, and a single woman like Natalie, who insisted on pursuing a vocation, even an artistic one, was treading a thin line between appropriate and inappropriate behavior. In May 1905, Charlotte Mason came to Natalie's social and creative rescue when she offered her the use of her apartment in Washington, D.C. Natalie needed a place where she could work on her Indian music book without interruption from friends and family, and she accepted Mason's offer and moved alone to Washington in late spring. But there were numerous distractions in Washington. Natalie socialized with officials from Roosevelt's Indian Affairs Department and accepted invitations to society functions where she could promote Indian policy reform. Although there was a continent between them, Charles Lummis remained in frequent contact with Natalie. In 1905, he was especially insistent that she become an active member of the Southwest Society of the Archaeological Institute of America. Considering that Natalie lacked affiliation with the academic community and that her credentials for her work among the Indians consisted of her passionate belief that Native music and stories needed to be preserved, the invitation to join Lummis's circle of scientists, anthropologists, and ethnologists was precisely the sort of endorsement Natalie wanted for her work. But she declined the AIA position, telling Lummis that every moment of my time is so absolutely taken up. But Lummis really wanted Natalie on the membership roster and told her so in several more letters. By 1905, Lummis had fallen from favor with Roosevelt, and he knew that her ability to get the ear of the most powerful American would be a valuable asset for both the AIA's and his own agendas. Natalie was likely privy to the disparaging comments and opinions of Lummis circulating drawing rooms on both the East and West Coasts. There was gossip about Lummis's indiscretions with women. He reportedly kept a log of his sexual exploits, and one California-based editor warned Roosevelt that Lummis is awful sharp, but a consummate crank of the first water, and will get you or anybody else in trouble. Never one to be swayed by gossip or to choose her friends for their social standing or political influence, Natalie was able to remain friends with Lummis and to also stay out of the trouble around him for decades. But it was not an easy friendship. Lummis continued his campaign to enlist Natalie into the AIA until December 1905, when he learned that she had joined the New York branch. Lummis wrote Natalie that he would prefer she be affiliated with the AIA's Southwest chapter, but added, "So long as you are in the Institute, I suppose we must not quarrel." Membership in the AIA did bring validation and recognition to Natalie and her work among the Indians. The Archaeological Institute of America was 25 years old and had backed field expeditions and surveys by America's most eminent anthropologists and ethnologists, including Lummis's friend, the Swiss anthropologist Adolf Bandelier. The same year that Natalie joined the AIA, the New Mexico-based anthropologist and AIA member Edgar Lee Hewitt was in Washington lobbying for the passage of the Federal Antiquities Act. Natalie may have met Hewitt in Washington in 1905. If not, she would meet him in the near future. Hewitt was touring the country on behalf of the AIA, encouraging cities to open local chapters and to financially and politically support the relatively new field of American anthropology. The AIA was very good company for Natalie to keep and offered her introductions to the Southwestern anthropology and ethnology community and to prominent leaders of the Indian policy reform movement. But Natalie could not stop work on her book to become a political activist. Throughout 1905, in spite of accelerated national activity around Indian rights and a burgeoning public interest in Southwestern anthropology and archaeology, Natalie kept her head in her transcriptions and field notes and her hands on her typewriter. Her book, entitled The Indian's Book, was completed by early 1906 and soon after accepted for publication by Harper Brothers. Natalie sent a copy of the manuscript to Roosevelt and asked him for an endorsement. Roosevelt's handwritten letter was placed at the front of The Indian's Book. These songs cast a wholly new light on the depth and dignity of Indian thought, the simple beauty and strange charm, the charm of a vanished elder world of Indian poetry. Roosevelt's words echoed the dominant sentiment among Anglo-Americans that Native America was in its last years and that the childlike red race would soon vanish. This limited and racist view of Indian America would be slowly replaced by the modern understanding of the intrinsic worth and enduring vitality of Native America. Although the Indian's Book reflected the prevalent Eurocentric view of Indian America, it was a major accomplishment and successfully gave the American public the first comprehensive collection of Native songs, stories, and ceremonies. Natalie's summaries of each tribe also introduced the general reader to the complex and numerous indigenous cultures that had existed and thrived on American soil for hundreds of years. The Indian's Book, an offering by the American Indians of Indian lore, musical, and narrative to form a record of the songs and legends of their race, recorded and edited by Natalie Curtis, was published by Harper Brothers in 1907. The first edition contained colored title pages and artwork. The book was illustrated by Hinuk Mahiwi Kilinaka, the Winnebago artist Angel Decora. Several years older than Natalie, Decora had already achieved considerable attention as an artist when she agreed to illustrate The Indian's Book. A graduate of Smith College, Decora was a member of the American Academy of Design by the age of 31, a rare honor at that time for a woman of any age or race. Harper Brothers sent out hundreds of review copies of The Indian's Book to scholars, editors, and politicians. By the end of 1907, Natalie's position as an authority on American Indian music was well established. her personal and professional life would never be the same. Aware that her audience would be reading about Indian America for the first time, Natalie assembled the material in the Indians book in an accessible and reader-friendly format.